You're listening to Daily Paul Radio. Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. WGRR Digital.
Welcome all you lovely people to Blue Republican Radio for the Liberty Curious. And you probably now have a good sense of that music that we play at the beginning of every show. It's from a track called Pendulum by a musician called Jordan Page. And if you're a hardcore liberty activist, you might well know who Jordan Page is. I am honored to say that not only is he an awesome musician, but he's also a friend of mine. And I love his work, and he was very kind in donating, as it were, that track for me to use on Blue Republican Radio. And I am excited that my friend Jordan Page is my guest this week. Jordan, hello and welcome.
How are you, Robin? Thanks for having me on.
Well, I am very well. How are you doing?
I'm excellent, man.
This is
excellent.
A good chance for me to thank you personally for the use of your music on my show.
Oh, it's my pleasure, man. It didn't take any convincing. You're an amazing activist, and you have a great vision.
Well, as they say, it takes one to know one, right?
Well, thanks for that.
Well, now, how long have you been in the liberty movement, broadly speaking?
You know, I woke up to what was going on, I guess, at the end of 2006. I was like anybody else out there, Robin. I didn't know what was happening, and I didn't – it's not so much that I didn't care. I just didn't have any connection to it. I had no response to it. I didn't have any vocabulary to articulate any sort of political philosophy. I'd never been exposed to it.
Mm-hmm.
I knew I didn't like George Bush, and I knew I didn't like the Iraq War, but that was about as far as I could talk about it. And I woke up by writing the song that you use as your bumper music, Pendulum. It was a song that was sort of given to me in the middle of the night. I woke up from a nightmare December the 1st, 2006. And I walked into my office, and I started typing words half asleep. And a few minutes later, the song Pendulum was born. I didn't understand a lot of the references in it. It was like I downloaded it from the ether, and it was like a gift that was just given to me. A couple weeks after I wrote it, I played it at this really great venue in Annapolis, Maryland called the Rams Head for about 350, 400 people, somewhere in there. And I got a standing ovation for the song, and which really showed me that the people in the audience knew what the song was about.
Uh-huh.
But I didn't, and it was clear to me that God had visited me and given me a gift and a message that I had to go and learn what it was about and really start doing my research. You know, as Bob Dylan said, in A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, I got to know my song well before I start singing. And so, you know, I found the nearest tinfoil hat I could find, and I put it on and spent the next year and a half just doing research. Eventually, about a year later, I found Ron Paul online, and I thought that he was amazing, and that I actually had a hard time believing he was real from all that I had learned, and that there was actually this politician who was an honest, you know, moral, you know, man with integrity who was actually fighting for liberty. It was just amazing to me. It really blew my mind. And a studio in Maryland, Studio 51, contacted me. They'd seen me at a show, and they asked me if I had any songs I'd like to record. They wanted to give me a free song because they wanted to get more into doing rock. And I said, yeah, I have a song. You know, it was Pendulum,
mm-hmm.
and I'd like to record. I recorded it, and XM Radio picked it up, and they played it on three or four different stations in regular rotation for about 2 years. And I sent the song to Gary Franchi from Restore the Republic, and then eventually Revolution Pack.
Yep.
And now he's the anchor at Next News Network. He's one of my best friends now. And I sent the song to him, and he loved it. And yeah, I sent him a few other tracks that I recorded, and he got me on the bill for the Revolution March, which happened in July of 08. And the Revolution March was in Washington, D.C. on the National Mall, right in front of the Capitol.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Ron Paul's last campaign event. It was his very last event, and it was my very first event. And that was the first day I met him and shared the stage with him. And it was, you know, he didn't realize it, but he passed me a torch. And I spent the next few years, you know, really building a name for myself and you know, promoting the message of liberty and doing lots and lots of shows all over the country. Eventually, Ron and his campaign staff caught on to what I was doing and started having me open for him at different shows. I ended up doing about 17 shows.
Fantastic.
For Ron. And I may be doing another one for him coming up on April 4th down in Florida for Campaign for Liberty Summit in Orlando. It's not 100% yet, but it's looking like it's going to happen. And, you know, I did about 17 shows for Ron, and you know, the Pauls, their whole family were very, very kind to me and my family. And I gained quite a bit of notoriety for opening for him. And I did a campaign song for him. And, you know, I just keep touring and promoting the message of liberty and, you know, trying to help craft the conversation, the national conversation, and influencing the culture to not accept tyranny as a standard way of life and to question everything, no matter how painful that process is. And, you know, music is a really non-threatening way to approach people with difficult subjects. And that's why I think I've been so successful with it, is that it gets into people and they don't even realize it. You know, I always use the analogy that, you know, water can get inside of a rock and split it open, and the same way that music can get inside of a person's soul and free them from the bonds of mental slavery.
Indeed. Yeah, God, that's so true. You've raised so many subjects that I hope we get to talk about in this hour we've got coming up. Now, just so I'm clear, that Pendulum was your first... Was that your first properly recorded song at all, or was that your first recorded song as a liberty activist?
That was my first recorded song as a liberty activist.
How long have you been going as a musician then?
I started, you know, playing music when I was 12 years old. It's kind of funny. I'll give you the lowdown on this. Like I ever since I was a little kid, I had this Fisher-Price record player, you know, the old one with the orange turntable on it.
Yes.
And when I tell the story, everybody knows this turntable. My mom was a big music person in the 60s, and she had all the Beatles 45s and Rolling Stones and Pink Floyd and Simon and Garfunkel.
She had good taste then.
What's that?
She had good musical taste then.
Oh, she had great taste. She had hundreds and hundreds of 45s. And so I would play these records over, you know, like I would go through them. I mean, they were gold to me when I was like, you know, 6 or 7.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I got to be about, you know, 10 or 11, I was doing a lot of acting. I was really into the arts. But it wasn't until I was 11 years old, my older sister rented the movie The Doors, the Oliver
right.
Stone movie with Val Kilmer playing Jim Morrison. She rented it on pay-per-view when my parents were, like, out of the house. Now, this is not a movie that an 11-year-old should see, let me tell you, for many reasons. But I saw it, and I had this this incredible just epiphany at 11 that I wanted to do that. I wanted to be the guy up on stage. I wanted to be a rock star. I wanted to write songs. I wanted to influence people, you know, and just do that whole thing. I had a very selfish, idealized, you know, idea of what I wanted it to all be. And because I just fell in love with Jim Morrison and the Doors music. The Doors were my very first love in life. And so, you know, it's funny because I recently connected with Sean Stone, who is Oliver Stone's son, who was actually in that movie and played young Jim Morrison. It's just kind of, you know, circle of life kind of thing. It's kind of funny. So I started playing guitar not long after I saw that movie. I worked my butt off for a summer, you know, just cutting grass and hedges and whatnot to save enough money to buy a guitar. And we moved 2 days after I bought that guitar. We moved from New England down to Maryland. It was a very difficult transition for me. And the music and the guitar and music were what got me through that time. And I got into poetry and I became a songwriter like right away. I've written over 100 songs, and most of them were about relationships, and they were just about the adolescent things that I was going through. But I was also a pretty spiritual guy. I was really into the writings of Khalil Gibran, who's a Lebanese author who wrote a very famous book called The Prophet. I became obsessed with his works and bought every book he had. And he taught me more about the English language and about poetry and verse than any musician did. But I was really into The Doors and Khalil Gibran. I got into Pearl Jam and the whole Seattle scene in the early 90s. And Alice in Chains was a huge influence. And then I got into U2 and the Chili Peppers and Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin. And all these bands just took over my life. I've had a lot of spiritual guidance.
Oh, hold on. You know what? Hold on. We'll carry on when we come back. Republican Radio for the Liberty Curious. This is Robin Kerner, the original Blue Republican. And you know, I'm an Englishman, and there was a famous conductor, a guy called Sir Thomas Beecham, and he said about the English that they don't know much about music, but they do like the noise it makes. That describes my level of musical ignorance, but I do like the noise that Jordan Page makes. And when we went into the break, Jordan was telling me about, well, your influences, right, Jordan?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, Brit rock was a huge, huge part of that. Zeppelin and Floyd, the Beatles, Eric Clapton. I mean, there's just so many. But, yeah, Brit rock has had a huge influence on the music of Jordan Page, no doubt. My teenage years were just saturated with music. I grew up listening to, as I said, mentioned the last segment, listening to my mom's 45s.
Yeah.
And I got really into the Seattle scene and, you know, Brit rock and all these just lots of different groups. I was very influenced by Bob Dylan, John Denver.
Yeah, even I could kind of hear that in your music when I was listening to you in Seattle a few months ago.
Yeah. Well, musically, Bob Dylan's voice and my voice don't have anything in common, but the way that he writes the lyrical style,
right,
of his style certainly had an influence on me. That there's no doubt about that. I don't try to pretend like it doesn't.
But, yeah.
But there's a lot of songwriters out there that have just, you know, blown my mind. And so I always wanted to be a musician. When I was 17 years old, I had a spiritual awakening where I was I was in high school. I was in class, and I just had a vision of what my life was going to be. And I kind of just left my body and astral traveled or did something weird, and I saw myself doing what I'm doing now.
So it was a pretty accurate vision, was it?
Well, it was accurate in the way that it looked, but it didn't have any context. I didn't understand what the context was, only that I was on stage performing, that I was talking to people, meeting people, having an impact in some sort of positive way.
And having a damn good time into the bargain, I should think.
Yeah, well, after that happened, I realized that I was being asked by the Almighty to, you know, go out and start accomplishing some task that he had asked me to do. And I just wasn't, I didn't want to. I'm scared and or weak or lazy or I don't know what it was. But I went the other way and started doing a lot of drugs and I went to college and was just a mess for a while.
What did you study at college? You study music or something else?
You know, I took one semester of music theory and it made me not want to be a musician anymore.
Yeah, right.
I didn't have any formal training at that point. I've been playing for 10 years at that point. And, you know, I didn't really even know what I was playing, just playing whatever sounded good to me, which, you know, there were advantages to that, but there were way more disadvantages. And, you know, I actually got my degree in cultural anthropology.
Okay.
And that took me to South Africa. I lived in South Africa for over half a year and studied the native township cultures and post-apartheid life in South Africa. I wrote a 120-page thesis on it in college, and it was just a huge turning point in my life. That's when I really grew up, was when I was over there. It's when I really became a student. I'd never been a student before that. I was a product of state-run education and had no work ethic as far as education went, and really grew a love for books and knowledge. And I wrote some of the best material of my life when I was there.
Mm.
I came back and graduated, and I went and did a year of service in AmeriCorps out in Seattle. I lived in Seattle, where you are, for over a year, and you know, trying to help kids, you know, who had been suspended or expelled from school, get rehabilitated, if that's a real word.
Yeah. Yeah.
And get back into their school programs, and that was really difficult. But I had this thing about Seattle, and there was this mystique about it, and you know, I just wanted to be there. I played a lot of music while I was there. I wrote a lot of songs while I was there. I love Seattle.
So do I. I loved it so much. I stayed. Yeah.
Well, it was a few years later I realized that I had another spiritual awakening again, and realized I had not done what I was being asked to do, and so I opened myself up and said, you know, I told God that, you know, give me the information you want me to have, and open the doors you want me to walk through, and I'll walk through them happily and wholeheartedly. And it wasn't long after that I met my wife, who was a direct catalyst to helping me get my music going as a full-time career. And I recorded an album. This is a very, very long-winded answer to your original question, which was, did I have any recordings before Liberty Stuff? And I had my first album was The Book of Life, which was released in 2005. And it was a very personal album. Some love songs, some spiritual songs, some just chapters in my life. One of the songs is The Book of Life, and it talks about the chapters in my life. It's a very deeply personal, beautiful record. I didn't have the budget to put into it what I would have liked, but it's still a very professional sounding record. People can find it on iTunes, all over the internet. Just look up Jordan Page of The Book of Life. And that was released in 2005. It wasn't until, and I didn't release anything else until 2009. So I'd written Pendulum in 2006,
mm-hmm.
and then I wrote Listen in January of 2007, and Song for Bob Dylan. And, you know, these songs were far outside what I had been doing before then, and they had so much meaning and so much passion, and they were so, you know, just full of juice. And I was scared of them, but I was in love with them at the same time. And playing them live was a real thrill, and the way people were reacting to the songs was a real thrill.
Yeah, I can speak from experience that, I've been in a room with you on a couple of occasions. You did a house concert up here in Seattle, and you and I were both kind of, I guess, you know, booked to do our thing at the RLC Convention of Washington State last year, right? And I heard you play both times, and it's really up there. It takes you away, and some of it shivers down the spine stuff, and you know, that's why I have your song on my show, and I have you on my show, I guess.
Well, I appreciate that, man. You know, I have the very same experience that other people do listening to these songs, because so many of these tunes, especially songs like Liberty and Pendulum, which were really, I feel like I was given them as gifts, because I wrote them so quickly. Too quickly for me to have really put any thought into them. You know, I mean, we're talking about a 5-minute song written in 7 minutes with some really, you know, powerful phrases and heavy subject matter. And I wish I could
have more experiences like that when I'm writing my articles. You know, so many of them take 8 hours. But I do know what you mean, though. I've had those moments where, you know, I'll go for a run, maybe, and then by the time I come back, the article's written. I don't know what's in it yet, but it's written. And then I just got to get to the laptop and knock it out, and sometimes they are the best. And that's, as you were kind of talking about this earlier, those times where you really feel it's coming through you and not from you.
Absolutely. You nailed it. That's it. That's totally it. It's coming through me, but not from me. And, you know, Liberty is probably my most well-known song. And that song absolutely wrote itself. You know, I had very little to do with that. I asked the first question in that song. I played a show at Drexel University in Philadelphia on a Young Americans for Liberty college tour I was doing in 2010. And this professor of political science came up to me afterwards, shook my hand, and he said, you know, I really like what you're doing because, you know, nobody's marrying music and politics anymore, and it's a real shame. It's really great to hear somebody doing it. He's like, but you're not there yet. And I was like, what? What a thing to say to someone.
Right.
And he said, don't get me wrong, it's not meant as an insult. He's like, you just haven't figured out the secret yet. And I said, well, what's the secret? And he says, you're not asking any questions. He says, you're great at pointing fingers at the problem. You're writing great songs. Your lyrics are good. It's very passionate music, but you're not asking questions of people. And that's how you convert them. He says, I don't agree with all of your politics, but it doesn't matter. If you ever hope to influence anyone to agree with what you're saying at all, or help them to see what you're talking about, you have to ask them questions. He says, think about all the protest songs that you love. And I'm sure you have them. He's like, I guarantee you they're full of questions.
Yeah, you know what? Jordan, hold on. That's a great place to end this segment because we're going into another break.
Okay, sure.
There with Jordan Page, we were just talking about the importance of, I guess if you're any kind of artist, if you're in any kind of creative field and you want to make a difference, of asking questions because, you know, when you invite people to answer questions for themselves, the answers stick, right? More than if you give them the answers. Jordan?
Right, right. Well, if somebody gets here's a question that they're forced to answer in their own mind. They don't have to say it out loud, but if they answer that question in their own mind, then they'll always have that truth. It won't be contingent upon what they think about you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you might fall from grace in their estimation, but they'll always have that truth regardless. You know, and you know, this professor that I was speaking of at the show at the college that I played at in 2010, you know, said this to me. And he said, you know, think about the protest songs you love. I'm sure they're full of questions. And the first one I thought of was Bob Dylan's Blown in the Wind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a song that's just full of questions.
Let me take this to a different direction, because you are going all around the country, you know, playing your songs. You see and meet, speak with, stay with liberty activists, you know, from Seattle down to Miami. What is your impression of the state of the liberty movement and of, like, let's call it small L libertarian culture in this country right now?
Oh, it's alive and well, man.
Yeah.
You know, one thing that I've been really, really pleased to see is that, you know, these house concerts that I do tend to be events that draw all the Liberty folks out of the woodwork, and then they all end up congregating in this one location and having fellowship over, you know, music, and everyone brings a dish, you know, and and people who haven't seen each other in months, you know, are getting back together, and they're like, oh, I miss you. I wish we saw each other more often. And then they start doing more activism together. It's been promoting activism.
So you see that your work has been catalyzing the work of others in the movement.
I mean, I hope so. It's certainly what it seems like.
Now,
I mean, I hope that's true. I mean, there's plenty of areas that with activists that are very much in full swing, regardless of whether I'm there or not.
Sure.
And there are people who are fighting the good fight, regardless if there's a Ron Paul to worship or not. You know, I mean...
Yeah, now, you know what? Now, this reminds me of a conversation you and I had. The first time I met you, we shared a car from the airport in Seattle through Olympia to the that RLC convention, right, that we mentioned earlier. And
right.
I seem to remember that you thought that I was – correct me if I'm wrong here, Jordan, but you felt that I was much more optimistic about our prospects for liberty in the U.S. than you were. Is that fair, and do you still feel that?
If I remember the conversation correctly, Robin, I think that at the time I felt that you were more optimistic about there being some political solution.
Okay.
Not so much that the prospects for liberty weren't good. I think the prospects for liberty are very good, especially when people are being backed into a corner by the state. There's only so much crap that people are going to take from a bully before they start hitting back.
Right. You know what? That's so true, and that is a point I've been making a lot recently with a lot of the articles and shows I've been doing talking about the history of liberty in the Anglo tradition. It's always been the case, it seems, pretty much always been the case, that societies move toward political liberty in response to being bullied. And it doesn't come out of the mass adoption of a particular ideology. It comes about from this sense of, you know, how the hell dare you? This isn't right. A more deep-seated, visceral sense of justice and fair play.
Absolutely. But if you're talking about fair play, then we're not talking about politics anymore. You know, I mean, politics is an elitist club that puts on this grand global theater to create a mass deception that the slaves or the livestock on the farm have any say in anything whatsoever.
So now, are you an advocate for you're an advocate for mass action outside the political system then?
Well, here's the thing. Public opinion is the only thing, in my opinion, public opinion is the only thing that matters anyway. And I'll give you an example. It's kind of an anecdotal example. But McDonald's, okay, you know, arguably one of the most recognizable symbols in fast food and chains in the world. Okay, everyone knows what McDonald's is. People in the Congo know what McDonald's is. Well, there is no reason for McDonald's to have a salad option. There's no reason whatsoever other than the culture changed and public opinion, you know, basically demanded it, that like the public, you know, wanted that. And so the market changed and it created a salad option at McDonald's, which is this institution. You know, when there is enough public outcry, anything can be accomplished politically. I mean, that's why I tell people all the time, I would rather take on the daunting task of converting 300 million people to the philosophy of liberty through music than try to change the satanic cesspool of evil that is our nation's capital. Okay, I mean, we're talking about the greatest terrorist organization in the world, the United States government. And
now
there is no helping them whatsoever. There is no changing that situation whatsoever. So why bother? I mean, I was in Tampa at the RNC. We saw the eyes have it for Romney before the vote was cast. The eyes have it was on the teleprompter before it was ever cast. It's all political theater, and in my experience, in my view, that's all that it is. It's just to convince. It's a mass deception to convince the people that any of it's real. The same way that they convinced us that that our fiat currency is worth anything at all. It's not. It's a lie. It's mass hysteria, mass deception, mass illusion. All warfare is based on deception. And the war against our minds, like the enslavement of our very selves, it requires deception in order to be accomplished. And that's just what we experience in government-run education. That's what we experience through our culture, which is heavily influenced by, elitist elements, taking over the music industry, the movie industry. The things that shape our culture are owned and operated by these same people who are writing our laws and passing these ridiculous laws. So, if we have a generation of enlightened, artistic, intelligent people who are changing the conversation, I'm one of many, many people, who are out there trying to change the conversation and focus it toward liberty and common sense, that's how things are going to change. It's only when people demand that the status quo be disrupted and they withdraw their support and their consent from
Absolutely.
The state apparatus that anything's going to change.
Now, pretty much everything you've said, I kind of pointed to a lot of it. I said a lot of it in almost the same way. In an article that I wrote at the end of last year, and I entitled it provocatively, I knew this would provoke all the libertarians, in times of tyranny, democracy is liberty's friend. The thing is, you've got to understand what democracy really is, and you've got to look to history for that. And you've just described it. Democracy is made up, that word is made up of demos, which means people, and kratos, which means power. And, we're doing the most democratic thing when we overturn the tyranny, and that doesn't mean that doesn't require that we operate within or without the actual political system, with the ballot box and everything. It could be either, but you are right that throughout history it's been when people have said enough is enough to the tyranny that is wielded by the elite, and that is a democratic with a small d action that it happens in the culture, and it's about getting the critical mass of the ruled, the non-elite, feeling exactly as you have described. And it 1776 was that, 1689 was that, and even 1215 in the Magna Carta was that, and there's a lot of dates in between, and we're certainly, I think, at a 1776 moment where let's say rebellion of a sort is appropriate, let's say. Would you agree?
Are you asking me if you feel like we're at that 1776 moment? Is that what you're asking?
Well, yeah, I guess I am. And I'm guessing I already know your answer, but go ahead.
Well, here's the thing. In 1776... there was only a percentage of the population that was dissatisfied.
Isn't that true now?
Well, absolutely, absolutely. But the folks that everyone respected, came to a consensus that it had to stop. But there was a great number of people in the colonies that had no interest in rebelling against the British.
But the minority was enough to cause the complete political change, right?
Absolutely, but it took words. It took a message.
Absolutely.
The Declaration of Independence was a big part of what inspired people and gave them an emotional response. See, right now, people are so distracted from reality by, disengaging agents like their gadgets, their phones.
Oh, I agree with this completely. Yeah, absolutely.
Their music, their film, everything is taking away the focus. I mean, you've got you're watching the news and some huge story has broken out, and all of a sudden they cut to Justin Bieber getting arrested for DUI, as though that's newsworthy. That is a deliberate manipulation of the people to keep them distracted away from the things.
Do you actually explain? Let me ask you about that, because you're saying that there is conscious, calculated, and nefarious intent.
Absolutely.
Now, who is it?
Without a hesitation's doubt, no, absolutely.
Really?
What's going on?
So. Now, but this would be quite a major conspiracy, wouldn't it?
it's the simplest thing in the world. You know, six corporations own every newspaper, news media outlet, internet magazine, what have you. Six major corporations own it all.
Mm-hmm.
They create the false reality that we live with every day. There are people all over the world arguing about things that don't even exist.
But do you not think – here's the question, I suppose, on that. Are you sure they're not doing that for profit? Are you sure they have any intent more nefarious than just keeping the shareholders happy?
Look, it's all part of the same war machine, okay? These same corporations that own the news also own companies that profit from war. So they have vested profit interests in keeping us misinformed, disinformed, afraid of our own shadows, to the point that we will give up our liberties with joy, with pleasure. We'll give up our liberties, just keep us safe. You know, if you repeat a lie over and over, the people will believe it, and you can make lots of money off of that. Look at the pharmaceutical industry, for example. That's another example of the same machine. The prison industrial complex, the military industrial complex, the pharmaceutical industrial complex. All these industries, these are multi-billion-dollar, trillion-dollar industries in some cases, that are unbelievably profitable, and keeping people in the dark is the easiest way to manipulate them. The easiest way to keep people from knowing what their rights are and keeping them away from their rights is never teaching they had them in the first place. If you grow up in a system, like, think about the genius of this. The clandestine, you know, wealthy elites who's you know, and there is a very real conspiracy, and it's not a theory. It was never a theory. It's always been a fact. It's just a matter of, do we have any proof? And there is tons of proof about this now. I even have a song now about how the conspiracy theories of, like, yesterday, the 80s and the 90s or whatever, are the headline news today. A lot of the things that used to be, like, crackpot ideas are commonplace knowledge now.
Courtesy of the NSA, some of them.
Courtesy of the NSA. Courtesy of Ron Paul. I mean, you know something? One in four people know what the Federal Reserve is now.
Yeah.
Thanks to his
I know. It's amazing, isn't it? It's amazing.
Which, you know, years ago, that subject was off the table. You don't talk about the Federal Reserve in any kind of negative way. The Fed is great. Without the Fed, we're sunk. Blah, blah, blah.
Now, when you consider, Jordan, sorry to interrupt, but when you consider that even 5 years ago, like, kind of almost nobody, you know, except some kind of weird, freaky libertarian types who followed this weird, freaky libertarian Ron Paul guy as he used to be, you know, as we used to be told he was, that they were the only people who even knew what the Federal Reserve was. And now it is a mainstream thing. I mean, you know, it is talked about on CNN or you know, MSNBC or whatever.
Right.
There's been, thanks to Ron Paul and a lot of people in the Liberty Movement who supported him, a lot of knowledge has been mainstreamed, if I can use that as a verb. At this rate, what is our time frame to get to where you would like us to get? If it's going to happen, what are we talking about? Are we talking about years? Are we talking about decades? Are we talking about generations?
More and more people are waking up every day, so I don't know, Robin. I certainly hope it's not decades, but again, it's all public opinion. Mm-hmm. Until the public at large has an emotional response to the to this stimulus, to this information, and they can see the truth of it and how it's going to affect them, how it's always been affecting them, they're not going to do anything about it.
And do you see?
If you don't know someone's robbing you, then how do you do anything about it? Once you can see that they're robbing you,
absolutely,
and you have the ability to change something, then you may act or you may not.
Now this is exactly what I kind of preach from this microphone and in my articles, is that we have to open people's eyes to the injustice that's being done to them. If we do that, a lot of the ideology kind of takes care of itself. You know,
absolutely, you're 100% right. This is another reason I love you, dude. Is you're 100% right on that.
That's a great way to end this segment. I'll take that at the end of the segment. We're going to be back in a couple of minutes. Thanks, mate.
Thank you.
great to speak with you for this last hour. We've just got a couple of minutes to close the show, so I want to throw it over to you and invite you to just tell the listeners what you're going to be up to in the next few weeks and tell them where they can get your work.
Well, right off the bat, they can go to jordanpagemusic.com, JordanPageMusic.com. And there's links to, you know, purchase music through iTunes and CD Baby and all my online outlets and see where I'm going to be playing. By the time your listeners hear this, I will have done a pretty major concert up in Northern California. There is an initiative on the ballot in Cisco County in Northern California for June the 3rd. It's Measure C, which is for Cisco County to secede from the United States of America and form its own sovereign republic called the Jefferson Republic. And I'm going to be there on March 22nd. So I'll be on my way home by the time your listeners hear this. But it's going to be quite an event. The following weekend, March 28th and 9th, I'm going to be in Visalia, California, and I'll be performing live at the California Libertarian Party State Convention. That's going to be a tremendous time. And then we'll be heading to Florida for April the 4th for the Campaign for Liberty Summit. And I will most likely be doing a show opening for Ron Paul. That's in the works. And then I'll be heading up to Rhode Island on April the 5th to headline at Liberty Love Fest, which is Liberty Love Fest 4. And if people go to libertylovefest.org, they can buy tickets there. And it's just going to be a great time. I'm taking the month of April off after that to have a baby. And I'll start touring again in May. I got some shows coming up with Panda, People Against the NDAA. Mm. And the weekend of May 25th, I'll be down in Atlanta, Georgia, doing a show for Panda. And I've got a lot of things coming up in June as well. So go to jordanpagemusic.com, also YouTube and Twitter, and just Google me. You'll find me. And I do a lot on Facebook, so look forward to seeing you all there.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Jordan. Thanks so much also to all my listeners for joining me. We're getting 10,000 downloads now on average a show. This is a pretty big number considering we've only been doing this for a couple of months. So thanks to all of my listeners for making this what it has already become. Take care until next week. Bye.
Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times, WGRR Digital.